I'm sorry to do this, but I'm going a little hardcore today. What I mean by hard, yeah, we're in Shmo. Hardcore.
Do you want to move the table back?
Already? Oh, yeah, I might as well. Every day.
Okay,
push. Aviva, push this way. There you go.
Thanks.
Okay. So I got an email from a friend of mine who lives in Gush for sending me to a blog saying that you got to respond to this. So now I'll read you the blog and I'll tell you why I have to respond. And
you
why.
Respond on your blog?
I did. Okay. Right then and there. We were granted, so this person writes, this is a rabbi, former rabbi from Chicago, or I think he's a lawyer, he's also has smicha. We were granted by God a great blessing. We have been given a land of milk and honey. Israel is a place where Jews can perform more mitzvot than anywhere else in the world. We can observe the laws of Truma and Maaser, Orla and Shemitah. And we can experience Yom Tov unlike anywhere else in the world. The way the Torah intended for us to observe it, at least to the best of our ability in post-temple times. We can flourish as a Jewish nation in all areas of life in the most Jewish of ways. Shabbos is the official day of rest. Jewish holidays replace Christian ones and are celebrated by all Jews who are a majority of the population. Israel is, in short, a place for Jews to be, where we can share a truly unified, holy Jewish life. It is a Torah nation, a kingdom of priests, free to serve God, unfettered by governments who would deny their people their freedoms. We should be a nation of scholars and workers. We'll get to the Chumash. Soldiers and sailors, farmers and entrepreneurs, artisans and craftsmen. A full-service nation. We should be a nation based on the ideals of Torah where every Jew serves God to the best of their ability and participates towards the common good in their own unique way. With love and just wait. With love and tolerance towards one another in complete brotherhood. The joy of living as Jews in Eretz Yisrael is something that all Jews should strive for. So, the Talmud tells us that the very air of Israel makes one wise. Certainly one can find in Israel the kind of dedication to Torah study unlike anywhere else in the world. What could be better than living a life like this? To borrow a phrase from the American Pledge of Allegiance, Israel should be one nation under God with liberty and justice for all. Now in bold. The real. Israel's air must be polluted. Because it seems to be making Jews...
Yeah, no, okay, so who's writing this?
The same person. Same guy.
Because it's the ideal and the real.
It seems to be making Jews stupid, not wise. Instead of unity, we have divisiveness. A divisiveness among Jews unmatched in any other part of the world where Jews can be found. In Israel, it is Jew against Jew. Too many Haredim hate Datim and secular Jews. Too many secular Jews hate all religious Jews. And religious extremists in Mea Shearim, who are spreading to other areas, think they're in charge of everything. They make every attempt to show it, making life miserable for everyone else. The level of intolerance by all makes it impossible for there to be any unity. The level of devotion to one's own hashkafa makes other hashkafas unacceptable. Israel has become a country of increasing extremes, extremes that are all gripped tightly by its various intransigent segments. Women harassed on buses. Buses are increasingly being stoned, ramping up hatred in response. Jews are calling other Jews Nazis or parasites. One demonstration breeds the next. Religious against secular against religious. I'm going to skip a little bit, whatever. Okay? I could go on. He goes on, but I'm skipping. But you get the picture. What happened to the milk and honey? Under these conditions, why would anyone want to make aliyah? I'll stop here. He goes on with the joke about, you know, living under Israeli bureaucracy, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, and the reason I'm starting with this and I have to go hardcore today is, like, what bothered me most is, like some of the facts of his blog are true. You know, like, there is too much divisiveness and there's too much extremism. And I'd love everybody to get along with one another. I wrote a strong response. If you want to read it, you could read it. But what does that have to do with making aliyah? Like, what's the connection between whether you like what you see on the news in Israel and whether you're supposed to make aliyah or not?
It's like saying if you have this is what bothers me. Isn't 100% perfect, you know, if there's some kind of
then forget it.
I mean, what's that?
Correct. And I think this is what my response, I'm going to actually have to write a second piece because my response was a response to what he wrote. But I have to respond to what underlies what he wrote, which really bothers me much more, which is, like, Jews in the Gola have created this sort of structure, and you see this more and more now, where we've built this kind of wonderful Gola Jewish society where, you know, life is good for us, and our kids are, you know, we're raising them in chinuch, and et cetera, et cetera. And so, therefore, it's like aliyah is a nice thing for those people who are into that kind of thing, but it's like optional, you know what I'm saying? It's not really part and parcel of what it means to be a Jew. And I think that that's something that you have to, you know, like, I'm never really that, I'm not, like, trying not to be that hardcore as hardcore as I'm going to be today. and say, everybody, you know, you all have to live in Israel. Like, you know, my message is that people should make the choice to live in Israel. But there are real reasons why people don't, and it is not easy. But at the same time, like, I get a sense that there's this sort of construction of this model where, you know, if it works for me, if I'm supposed to, then I have to live in Israel. But otherwise, you know, it's really like one of the things that I could choose to do. Like, I could choose to cover my hair or not, and I could choose to, you know what I'm saying, to send my kids to this school or that school, and I could choose to live in Israel or not live in Israel. And nothing could be farther from the truth. Like, we've lost a sense of what it's supposed to be an Am. And that's really, like, I say all this as an introduction, because that's what Sefer Shemot is all about. Like, what happened to us? And what did we need to do in order to get back to who we're supposed to be? You know, the story we're going to start at the very beginning of Shimon, just learning in the Chumash, and I'm going to end with a piece of the Kli Yakar. But, like, is it, like, where do we go from the story of an Am Yisrael, being a nation, being part of Eretz Yisrael, being together, whether you like it or not, and it's like, okay, you don't like what you see here? There's a very, you know, there's a very simple option. Come here and fix it.
But when you look into history, there were always conflicts between, like, in Am Yisrael. We were not, like, things were not, like, beautiful and everybody loved each other.
That's obviously true. I wrote that. So that's obviously true. And the thing I said was, like, first of all, don't kid yourself into thinking. Don't kid yourself into thinking that Jews in America, America, get along.
Each other there.
They don't like each other. They don't get along. But the reason they don't fight so much, you know the reason they don't fight so much in America?
Because now they have more space.
They don't have anything to do with each other. That's right. They don't have anything to do with each other.
The Haredim live in their homes.
That's right. They never see each other, not in shul, not in school, not in community institutions. There's no interaction. There's no overlapping. And when there is, then they fight. You know what I'm saying? So you hear of it less. That's one. Between different denominations of Jews.
And outside of Israel.
Outside of Israel. I go to my shul. I see my friends. Where do I see you? In the store? What do we have to fight about? I send my kids to my school. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Here, everybody's fighting over in the same pie. The issues are really important. They're critical. So they're going to fight. That's A. B, you don't like it. It's like, oh, so why would anyone want to make aliyah? That sentence, like, really bothering me. What does one have to do with the other?
It sounds like he's trying to justify his own staying in America.
Yeah, I don't know. It does sound like it. But that's exactly my point. Like, to what degree is that an attitude? Like, and other than being, like, and what I want to, like, get to, we're talking about, Shemot is about Shibud Mitzrayim. How did it happen? You know what I'm saying? This attitude, I don't know how much it affected you, but in my back of my mind, like, there was always this sense. I always had this sense that, like, you got to understand, all the Jews will be living in Israel, you know, and sometime in the foreseeable future. I don't know when it's going to be, 10 years, 20 years, 100 years. We will be living in Israel.
Where does it say that?
What?
Where does it say that?
Even
when Mashiach comes, there may be Jews that will be living outside of Israel.
Why would you say that? Wouldn't Mashiach v'kabetz, don't we say, right? V'havien l'tzion me'arba kanfot ha'aretz. The goal of Mashiach, of the redemption, is to bring us all together. And so the choice is, and that is the story of Mitzrayim, by the way. What happened to the Jews? You think all Jews left Mitzrayim?
Yeah.
So what happened to the ones that stayed? Assimilated or died or perished, right? All Jews, I believe, all Jews, sometime in the future, near future, far future, will be living in Eretz Yisrael. Actually, can you get me the phone so I'll turn it off? It's in my jacket. I just don't want to bother us. We'll be living in Eretz Yisrael. That doesn't mean that all Jews will come to Eretz Yisrael. You understand what I'm saying? You just can't find it. Okay.
I don't like going to show it on the jacket. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Thank you very much. Okay. Okay, I'm sorry about that. And that was always a thing in my mind. Like, the story of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, it's the story of Bnei Yisrael. Maaseh Avot Siman Lebanim. It happens again and again and again. You know what I'm saying? And this illusion that it's a choice, might be a choice for you, but the choice that you're making for you, and this was, I don't know, was a factor in your mind. It was just a factor in my mind. The choice that I'm making for me, as hard as it is, I'm not making it just for me, I'm making it for my children and their children and their children. It was a factor for you. You know what I'm saying? And that's our story. So that's an important, you know, take that into account. It's not like, oh, you know, why would anybody want to do this? It just bothered me, as you could tell. We'll get back to this at the end. Because It's not. It's, the redemption is not. It's not obvious. It's not necessary. It's not going to happen per se. It all depends on how we act and how we behave, and whether we choose to take part in it or not. That's an important thing to notice. Ve'eile shemot bnei Yisrael haba'im Mitzrayim et Yaakov ish ubeito ba'u. There are problems with this pasuk from the beginning of the pasuk to the end of the pasuk, all up and down. Okay, there's textual problems and contextual problems. Anybody want to throw one out? Before we go, we're gonna rip these first few psukim apart. Et Yaakov, ish ubeito ba'u. Let's say some simple ones. Ish ubeito ba'u. What is the significance of ish ubeito ba'u? Et Yaakov, ish ubeito ba'u. What is ish ubeito? Each person and his family.
And his household.
And his household.
They weren't just passing through.
No, every word is significant, right? So what do I need to know? Each man came with, of course he came with his household. Isn't that obvious? He came without his household?
No. Okay. As opposed to just coming and working and sending the goods back home.
That's not really...
No, they came as a family.
Okay. Okay, but... Ish ubeito. Focus on bite. We're going to get... The midrash is going to pick on that. First word is problematic. What's problematic with the first word? Why is it a problem?
This isn't now. They were already there.
Well, first of all, that's the contextual problem. Right? Why is the Torah repeating information that we already know?
In case you got the wrong book out.
What's that?
In case you pulled this book out before reading
it. Oh, you didn't read the last book. Oh, like, we can assume that you read the last book and know that all the Bnei Yisrael, the very last book ended with, you know what I'm saying? Yosef died and all that we already know. And in fact, the Torah had already done what? We find almost this identical pasuk in Bereshit. Yaakov went down to Mitzrayim, and the Torah went out of its way to count all the people.
Yeah,
70 people. So, like, why are we going back and telling us information that we already know? What's wrong with the first word? Ve'elu. I didn't know that. Ve'ele. Shemot. The Midrash picks up on. What's ve?
Ve.
Ve means, and what? Right? When you start a book, how do you start a book? It's the beginning of Sefer Shemot.
Once upon a time.
Once upon a time. What if I started it and once upon a time? And what? Meaning what? There's somehow some connection, right? And ve'ele. You have to go back and look at what. How did the last book end? Yosef died. And these are the names. It's very strange. Okay, what's the ve'ele? Okay, and why does the Torah tell us? So obviously we're going to stick with Rashi, and then we're going to do a couple of the Mefarshim. But because the Torah then goes on to list the names of the Shvatim. Listen, it's very strange. Ve'eile Shemot, says Rashi, Afapi Shemana'an b'chayehen b'shemotam. So Rashi, see that Rashi asks our question. Without asking it, he just says it. Even though the Torah counted them in their lifetimes by their names. So what's Rashi's question? Why I count them again? Okay, why is them again? Chazar u'mina'an b'mitatan achar mitatan. So it's the Torah went back and counted them again. Even though we did it, we're counting them again. So the obvious question is why? L'hodia chibatan. To tell you how beloved they are. Shenimshalu l'kochavim. They are compared to the stars. Shemotzian u'machnisan b'mispar u'b'shmotan. That he brings them out and brings them in, okay, according to their numbers and their names. It's a very interesting comparison to the stars. Very interesting. We'll stop in a second. Shinmar, as it says, Hamotzi b'mispar tzva'am l'kulam b'shem yikra. Right, who brings them out according to their names of their hosts. They were all called by name. So why does God re-enumerate each of them by name? Because God loves them. Okay? Response?
I'm just thinking sometimes I forget my kids' names. And it like really bothers them.
But I don't know why. But you.
Yeah.
You.
The stars aren't counted.
Well, the stars aren't counted. First of all, it's unusual. Okay.
Of the bracha that they would be like the stars.
Really? 12? All 12? The bracha of the stars. The bracha of the stars is you'll be so many that it's uncountable, that you can't count it. Right here, it's like, oh, you're like the stars. The whole Rashi is very nice. It's very midrashic. Right? Why does God mention them again? Because he loves them. And we see that often, very often, that, you know, why does God count them? Because he loves them. I'm looking for something a little more. Actually, the Kli Yakar has a nice long essay. So why does it compare them to stars? Is the comparison to stars a positive, or is the comparison to stars a negative? And because what do you know about stars?
But stars are what they do.
What?
They all look the same.
Well, they all look the same, but more importantly,
They're always there.
Good. The stars are always there, but on the other hand,
you can't always see them
until it's night. So the Kli Yakar says that the comparison to the stars is very interesting. He said because you only know whether a person was really a tzaddik after they're dead. Because during their lifetime, you never really know a person. You never really get a sense, and you don't know if their whole life they're gonna fulfill their destiny. So he says the only way that they're really like stars was after the shvatim passed on to the next world. Then we know that they're really tzaddikim. And that's not really a very positive perspective on the stars. Okay, but the Rashi is very nice. But I'm looking for something a little bit. You know what I'm saying? That's why God brought them. I'm listening a little bit more. What?
Hashem's there for us when it's dark.
Okay.
When it's dark outside, he is there to light the way, like the stars light the way in the dark.
Okay, let's look at Rashbam. You guys have Rashbam here?
I'm stretching.
Well, yeah, you are stretching. All right. So Rashbam, okay, just so you know. So you have Rashi. When Rashi is looking for Pshat, as we discussed many, many times, what's the Pshat he's going to draw from? Always? From the Midrash. Okay, Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, he's not limited to that. He's much more interested in the pshat in the text. Says Rashbam be'elah shemot, mipnei shirotzel lefaresh v'lomar b'nei Yisrael paruva yishvitzu, because the story is going to tell you that the Jewish people multiplied many, many times over. Hutzrach lichpo b'nei v'lomar, so therefore it has to come back and say, b'biatam lemitzrayim lo hayu shiv'im. So it makes it much more effective from a literary sense to say, wow, they were, you know, in the end, how many were they? Millions. How did they start? 70. It doesn't even start with 70. It makes it even less. It starts with
12.
Starts with 12. They started these little people, and before you know it, boom! So that Rashbam is very powerful. It's a little more effective in a sense. They started from nothing. They weren't even a clan. They were a family, a couple guys. You know what I'm saying? And before you know it, they're this incredible nation. That's to emphasize the power. So it's very interesting. You have on the one hand Rashi, which is very like beautiful ideologically midrash. And then you have Rashbam who says, no, it's to tell the story. And it is more effective in the story itself. Now we're going to see Ramban. Ramban comes in from a sort of intermediate perspective. You have Ramban or you have Rashi?
Right.
The Rashi one. Okay, so the Ramban actually, he has an introduction, a very interesting introduction to the whole book. So the Ramban starts, you see on the top? Okay. Hishlima katu sefer Bereshit, shu sefer Yitzira. Okay, the Torah finished the book of Bereshit, which is the book of creation, b'chidush ha'olam, v'yitzirat kol notzar, in the creation of the world and the creation of everything that exists. U'b'mikrei ha'avot, the stories of the forefathers, kulam she'en ke'en yitzira lezaram. They are part of the rooting, the create of creation, of formation. Mipnei she'kol mikreihem, everything that happened to them, tziurei dvarim. They create images and ideas, lirmos, to give hint, lahodia kol atid lavo lahem. It's a very famous theme in the Ramban. Ma'ase avot, siman lebanim. That which happened to the avot, will happen to the banim. That which happened to our forefathers, that which happened to our ancestors, will happen to us. It happens again, and again, and again. And anyone who doesn't think so is kidding themselves. You know what I'm saying? And that like, I don't know, it's very doomsday-ish. But you're joking, you're kidding yourself, you think that it's not true. Right, we have historical truths, and the historical truth always was the Jews in Egypt said, "Life is great in Egypt. We get along with the Egyptians. Everything is wonderful. What could be better?" Because they were right, until they weren't right. What?
Until it wasn't so great anymore.
And then, like, it just history just repeats itself. And no matter how correct we are about how wonderful everything is today, and it is wonderful, and it's undeniable. Ma'ase avot siman lebanim is a. It is wonderful. Oh, I'm sorry.
Princess Solomon, they were egg coming out of shul the other day.
Come on, the President of the United States just hired an Orthodox Jew to be his chief of staff.
Yeah, and you have the Mac beats playing in the White House.
Give me a break. It's great. It's.
From my
Is We've reached the pinnacle of acceptance and power. The only thing more could be if the President of the United States himself was an Orthodox Jew, and that almost happened. You know what I'm saying? It wasn't pasul from and of itself. Yeah, you know, like, give me a break. You can't. It's not bad. So somebody threw an egg. Come on. You know, like, it's just an egg. You know what I'm saying? Could have been hung. Okay?
You know,
let me put it this way. The fact that you're thinking that's bad tells you just how good it is.
I don't think it's the beginning of...
Nah, I'm not even going there. You know what I'm saying? I think... whatever. Okay.
I think it's been worse, like, in the past, but, like, I think in our lifetime, that didn't happen. Like, at least I grew up on a delusion. Like, that didn't happen. We were fine. Everyone accepts us.
No, girl.
Other people don't throw eggs at Jews.
I got eggs thrown.
Yeah.
I never got egg, but you did?
I had swastikas burned on my fence. I had people beating me up all the
time. Where do you grow up?
In Atlanta.
Ah, okay. You're right. Okay. Very nice. V'lachen. One second. Okay. V'achar shishlim ha-yitzira, hitchil sefer acher b'inyan ha-maseh ba min ha-ramazim ahim. So now this new book is telling you the story that emanates from these hints that we had in Bereishit. Meaning, Abraham went to Mitzrayim, right? And his wife was taken from him, right? And then he left Birchush Gadol. There's many parallels that we're not going to discuss today. So to the Jewish people, went down to Mitzrayim. V'lachein, v'nityached sefer ve'ele shemot v'inyan ha-galut ha-rishon ha-nigzar b'feirush. So the book of Shemot starts with the idea of the galut, the exile, that was prophesied explicitly. V'geulam mena, in the redemption. V'lachein, chazar v'hitchir b'shemot yardei Mitzrayim u'mismisparam, the Torah went back and on the story, af al pishakvar nichtav, even though it was already told, b'avur, because ki yuridatam sham hu reishit hagalut. So he says, yes, we know the story. But that story was the story of the Avot. This story is the story of the nation. So therefore, the Torah is going back and starting again because while it's the same facts, it's all in a different context. It's a very powerful idea. You know what I'm saying? It's a very, very beautiful and a very powerful idea that you have to read the book of Shemot and it's just a different context. It's not, yes, the facts are the same. Yes, the facts are repeated. We do know the information. But the information is new vis-a-vis the context you put it in. And that's an important thing to understand, that you have to look at everything in its proper context.
That's supported by the way it first says that these are the names of Israel, and then it, when it gives it in detail that it's Yaakov's children. Like it's saying, like, the intro is, here's the story of Israel, and the names, these are Yaakov's children.
Right, meaning, what are you trying to say? Just strengthen it.
I'm saying that the
focus
the
your...
The Pasuk is, it supports...
Ramban's
idea that it's that, you know, this is the story of Am Yisrael.
Ah, very good. Exactly. They call them Bnei Yisrael. They don't. And then who's Bnei Yisrael?
But the historical facts are Yaakov.
Exactly. Exactly. I agree. I think it's a very compelling idea. And Ramban, the Midrash calls this. The Midrash calls this Sefer HaGeula, right? The Book of Redemption. By the way, just as the information, the names that we call them. What's it called in English?
Exodus.
Right. Where'd that come from? Exodus.
Greek.
Exodus. The book of the redemption. The book of Exodus. Okay?
Divided the five books. We did.
No, the Torah is divided. Hashem divided the five books. Divided. Okay, but who called them the five books? What's it called in English?
The five books of
Pentateuch. No, what's the first one called?
Who translated
Genesis. Genesis. What did the Ramban just say the first book is called?
Creation.
Sefer HaYetzirah. Right, so just to understand that these books, these names, these English names are not non-Jewish names. They're very Jewish names. They're Chazal's names for the books. Okay? What do they call Vayikra?
Leviticus.
What does Chazal call it? Torat Kohanim. The book of the Kohanim. Right? Bamidbar Numbers, they call it Sefer HaMispar, Sefer, I don't remember what it's called. And of course, the last one is called Mishnah Torah. Mishnah Torah, second Torah, Deuteronomy. You English people can divide Deuteronomy, second teaching. So, like, all those names, you don't know, those English names are not some professor, you know, in Harvard somewhere did it. It's the Chazal's names. Okay, so that's very nice. We don't want a little bit in the Ramban. Okay? Hinei ha-galut eino nishlam ad shuvam el mekomam ve'al ma'alat avotam yashuvu. It's very important, right? The galut is not completed until they return to their place and ma'alat avotam, and the exalted place of their forefathers. Meaning the galut does only ends when the book ends. Well, really, how was the book supposed to end? But didn't end. How was the book really supposed to end? Shemot.
In
Eretz Yisrael. Right, but it didn't because it got pushed off. Why did it get pushed off first? Before the Meraglim. It got pushed off 40 years because of the Meraglim.
Right.
But it got pushed off before that because of Chet HaEgel.
Right. Right.
The Chet HaEgel delayed them. They were supposed to get the Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu was supposed to come down. Let's go. But they didn't. He came down. He broke the Luchot. 40 days. You know what I'm saying? So he's saying, but we're supposed to, the Ma'alatam, when they build the Mishkan and they're ready to go, that's the end of Sefer Shemot. And I just said a very important point. You know what I'm saying? Ma'alatam isn't, oh, you know, the life that I think I'm supposed to be leading. There's an end. There's a goal. There's a goal of redemption. And until we reach that goal of redemption, we're not whole and we're not complete. And I'm back on my soapbox, I'm explicitly saying it. That's something that's lost among Galut Jewry today. You know, it's just lost. You know what I'm saying? It's lost this notion that we're supposed to reach our Ma'alatenu. Like, one gets a sense. Like, it's very interesting. When the Jewish people were kicked out of Eretz Yisrael, right? Chazal, they had a big problem. Their big problem was, what do we do to make sure that this people doesn't fall apart? They don't assimilate, they don't literally disintegrate before our eyes. And they came up with a brilliant idea. They created a rabbinic Judaism focused on community, focused on ritual, that gave us a sense of continuity. They also had a big problem. Their second problem was, what do we do to make sure that these people in their place still want to come back? So they rooted in the religion, in the rabbinic religion that they created, just this incredibly strong sense of this yearning for Tzion. Think about how many times we mention it throughout the Haggadah and Pesach, Zecher Yetziat Mitzrayim. They seeded our religion with this sense of yearning to return.
Except that part of what I see the problem with how it was done for some people is that they think that they're only meant to return when Mashiach comes.
So they may, you know what I'm saying? Right. 100%. I agree with you. That it has to be miraculous and it has to be
right,
supernatural.
Yeah.
So we disagree with that. I mean, but I hate to break it to you. That's a very, nowadays, it's a very, very fringe element. That we have to wait only for Mashiach to come.
No.
Yeah.
I think it's fringe. How you see Galut. What's Galut? Are you in the diaspora and everyone's in Galut, including the Jews in Eretz Israel? Or are you out of Eretz Israel and in Galut? If it's the latter, then you'll come and make Aliyah at some stage, or at least yearn for it.
Right.
If not, why would you...
Right. So one gets a sense that I get the sense that they did such a good job that sometimes like it's missing, like it's lost. I don't know if you ever saw, somebody wrote this piece about, you know, like, I don't know what it's like, but I really like 2 days of Yontif, and I can't imagine like living in Israel when, you know, when there's only one day of Yontif.
Right, and you can.
Did you see that? Did anybody see that? No, that's by the way. That's what she said. She said. First night of Pesach, I'm so tired. The second night after a nap, you know, then the second night is better. I had to, you know what? She's right about that. But who said that you're not supposed to take a nap the night before the day before Pesach? Who said that you're supposed to be so discombobulated and, you know, last minute? She also said, Shavuos is not good. Like, Shavuos is not good. It can't be in Israel because, like, the men stay up all night and then they kill the whole first day. And then the second day is much more family-oriented. I agree with her. Nobody said that the men are supposed to stay up all night in such a way that they're supposed to ruin Yontif. Right. That's correct. You know what I'm saying?
I'm not getting that.
What?
I'm not getting that.
You're not getting. You understand what I'm saying? Meaning, but like, but because of that, it must be better to have 2 days Yontif because, you know, like.
Because it's lonaim to say that there's no Sundays, and it's lonaim to say that you're not going to have. So you can find the other reasons that are like.
But there's no, there isn't this sense. There isn't this sense of. 100%. But there isn't this sense of. For those listening in Chutz Laaretz, we told you to be hardcore. Whoops. Today. For those, you know what I'm saying? sorry.
Come,
right? But like, there isn't this sense of incompletion, of lack of completion. And when you learn the Chumash, you have to, this is the sefer of galut. What is galut? Of being sent out, of not being your complete selves, of you, of leaving your land, leaving your place, and rooting yourself in another place, and suffering the consequences thereof. And nowadays, it's not there. We're still in Goshen, and it's still great. Okay, so we had three answers, three explanations of why the Torah is listing it. Rashi, which is the beautiful midrashic sense of his love for them. We had Rashbam, the textual sense, going from very small to very large, and then Ramban, which is much more of, I don't know how you describe it, an ideological view, a view of the whole book. and trying to restart the book because of it. It's a sort of more thematic kind of explanation. Ish ubeito ba'u. What does it mean, ish ubeito? Says the Midrash. I'm reading about Midrash. I don't know, does Rashi bring this Midrash? Let me see if I can find. No, I don't think so. It's not brought in Rashi. Midrash says, Amar Rabbi Chama. Rabbi Chama said, V'vishi yadua yada Yaakov avinu sha'mitzvim shtufim bezima. Yaakov knew that the Egyptians were engaged in all kind of sexual inappropriateness. Lekach amar v'hisiyet banav u'bnei banav nashim. So therefore, he married all of his children and his girls' grandchildren off before they got to Egypt. Because he knew that if anybody was there single, it'd be bad. Excuse me. So there's this idea that Yaakov Avinu, like he's like, we're going out of our own confines. We're going into this other place. How is this other place going to influence us? Very, very badly. So therefore, I'm going to do everything I can in order to make sure that they're protected. Okay? I'm going to read on. Reuven Shimon Levi Yehuda, and stop there. Listen in. Reuven Shimon Levi Yehuda, Yisachar Zvulun Uvinyamin, Dan Naftali Gad Vasher. Vayhi Kol Nefesh Yotzei Yerach Yaakov Shivim Nafesh, VeYosef Haya B'Mitzrayim. Says the Midrash on Reuven. And this is a very famous Midrash. Okay? And we're going to see Kli Akar on it in a second. Reuven. Rabbi Lezer HaKafar B'Rabbi Omer. Right? Why in the world did the Jews survive? Why didn't they assimilate? This is the question. The question isn't like, I'm sorry, the question is, why did they survive? I lost my train of thought. By all rights, when you take one people and you put them in another place, right? By definition, they assimilate, they intermarry, they become part and parcel of, and just look, by the way, how, like I was thinking how interesting it is, how different we become. You know, you're that South African drawl that you got rid of to become more American. Like we want to be as American as we possibly can.
But you still have, I mean, you see other communities, like I come from Melbourne, Australia.
Yeah.
And there was always the Italian community and the Greek community and the Lebanese community, and they all had their. Yeah.
Let's remember that in our modern day times, right, we celebrate multiculturalism, right? But way back when, they didn't celebrate multiculturalism.
Melting pot.
Right. That was, America celebrated the melting pot, okay? For a long time in America, it was exactly the opposite. You wanted to become as American as you could. And America was extremely... It was like, you know, the...
You're an American first and foremost.
That's right. And what happened to most of the Jews? What happened to most of the Jews? Right. They assimilated really quickly. And only after time, this idea of multiculturalism... You know what I'm saying? The idea that a religious Jew could be the chief of staff of the President of the United States was unthinkable. And if he did, the only reason he got there was because... This guy did too. It's interesting to me. I was actually thinking about this. Did you notice? Did you see it? He wasn't wearing a yarmulke. I wonder, like in today's day and age, why he doesn't feel like he has to wear a yarmulke in the White House. Right. I just wonder. It's interesting. Not that it's not a criticism.
You're a Muslim.
It's a question. What? You think it should be criticized?
Then you're a Jew. Yeah, if you were a Muslim, you would have a headdress
proudly.
But then he would never get appointed as the chief of staff of the United States.
Yes, he would.
You think it should be a criticism? Oh, interesting. I don't know. I'm torn. I'm torn about this issue. What?
If you're saying that's how you're affiliating with a religious Jew,
then... Wear a yarmulke.
Yeah.
All right. Good question. Anyway, so how is it that they did not assimilate...
But if he does something wrong, he's going
to
bring
him. You could. Oh, it's not... You're allowed to.
Yeah.
But in this day and age, Barack Obama was elected president of the United States. He didn't change his name to Bill O'Malley. You know, it's Barack Obama.
Barack Hussein
Obama. And he got elected. So it says the Midrash. What four things? The very famous four things. By the way, you know three of them. Do you know what the three are? What about them kept their tzivyon, kept their uniqueness?
Their clothing and their language.
Very good. There's a fourth. Did you know there's a fourth?
Uh-huh.
Okay. V'chilai abiyadam sh'Yisrael arba mitzvot. Okay, they did not with each other. They kept their marital purity with one another. V'lo al lashon hara, right? They didn't speak lashon hara about each other. Yeah. V'lo shanu et shinu et shemam. They didn't change their names. V'lo shinu et lashonam. They didn't change their language. It didn't say they're clothes, right? In this version, it doesn't
probably
say they're clothes.
The first one is probably... You can't really say that to kids.
What do you mean?
You don't really say the kids. They kept their relations with each other. Tsanua, you just say they kept their dress, Tsanua.
Yeah, I mean, there, I think there's other verses of the Midrash. Right. Yeah. Sometimes we hide from our children too much. Right? All right. We don't, the Lashon Hara one you didn't hear either. Says the Kli Yakar. So the Kli Yakar picks up on this and says, Ulefi Zeh, he says, if this were true, then if they had changed their names, then what? They would not have been redeemed. Because, and what's unique about their names? He says, the uniqueness of the names is, one second, Reuven, each name was Re'e Ra'iti Et Ani Ami. Behold, I saw the poverishness of my nation. Shimon, he says, Al-Shem Ba'ishma Elohim Et Na'akatam. The names came to take on a national significance. That the names that they had, it wasn't just, oh, you know, I'm going to call you Barry or Seymour or whatever. You know what I'm saying? The quote-unquote Jewish names. But the Jewish names had a nationalist significance. They remember who you are. They remember you are part of a people. And therefore, if they had gotten rid of those names, if they hadn't kept their names, they would have forgotten their own identity. Okay? And he says, if they would have changed their names, Lo haya lehem roshem al ha-ge'ula. They would not have remained this with this roshem, this impression of the redemption. Velo hayu re'uyin lehigael. And then they would not have been merited to be redeemed. Which only goes back to my theme that I'm hammering home. Right? The idea of redemption is based upon the people's desire to be redeemed. Because if they had said, shoin, whatever, and they would not have been redeemed. Okay, achar, wait a second. Achar sheichlivu et shemotam amorim al ge'ula, if they would have abandoned their names, that reminds them of redemption. Bekorem shem chadash asher ein bo hora'a al ge'ula. You know what I'm saying? They would just give another name. Oh, hayalem shinui hashem, if he gave them another name, sivali hityaesh min ha-ge'ula, to give up from the ge'ula. They give you a new name. The new name is, we love it here, everything's great. Let's stay in America. Right? That's not a good name. That's not a really good name. The name is the name that reminds you of who you are and who you're supposed to be. And if you forget them, and by the way, when did the redemption really begin? When did the redemption really begin? When did the whole, in this week's parsha, anybody know? When does the whole story begin? Vayitzaku el Hashem. It does not begin until they cry out to Hashem.
They cried out to Hashem because of the names that they had.
Well, they cried out to Hashem because the work was terrible, because the suffering was terrible.
Yeah, but in other words, they remembered that Hashem said he was going to redeem
them. Mm-hmm. He says the same thing about their language. And he says if they changed their language, if they had changed to another language, then the names wouldn't have been meaningful anymore. So they have to keep their language. And then the other two were about the nature of the people. But this is a very, very powerful and like, why, you know, I'm saying, why list these names? Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda. Kli Yakar says because these names had meaning for them. Like, these are the names of our forefathers who were in this place. And we can't forget them. We have to remember them. We have to remember the nature of them. Is everybody cold? Turn on the heat. You all good? You're good. All right. Let's go on. Vayihi, pasuke. What? Vayihi. And it was, kol nefesh yotzei yerech Yaakov, shivim nefesh. Right, 70 people there. Yerech Yaakov, shivim nefesh. V'yosef haya b'mitzrayim. And Yosef was in Egypt. V'yamot Yosef v'chol echav v'chol hador hahu. Okay? Yosef died, and all of his brothers, and all the Jewish people, and all that, and all of that generation. And the Midrash says, right, as long as Yosef was alive, and all the generation was alive, he says, Yosef died first, interestingly enough. Until Levi died, until the last of the old generation died, they were protected. Once Levi died, all bets were off. Ubnei Yisrael. Paru vayishritzu vayirbu vayatzmu bimod maod vatimale haaretzotam. I find that pasuk very, very compelling. Okay, let's translate the words. Let's read it together. B'nai Israel, paru multiplied vayishritzu.
Like sherets.
What?
Like sherets. Like.
Oh, yeah, it's a very strange word, isn't it? Vayishritzu. What does it mean in this context?
Increased abundance.
They increased abundantly, like vermin. Right? What's a sheretz? A sheretz is...
Terrible image.
Yeah. Is it a terrible image?
It is. Vayirbu. What?
Rabbits. Cousin.
Like rabbits. Rabbit is a
shape. Some of the sort of describing how they multiply, but also maybe how it was seen by the Egyptians.
Ah, very good, right. Very good, very good. Yeah. Okay? But it doesn't say that necessarily. It's not clear.
Well, it just sort of reminds me when you used to hear, like, you know, sweet stories about Nazis calling Jews vermin.
Correct. So
it's like,
correct. Like, you can't keep them down. Like, no matter what you do, you just look at you like, you know, like animals. They just multiply like animals. It's crazy. Vayirbu, vayatsmu, and they were like peru revu. Vayatsmu. Atsmu.
They got stronger.
Bimaod, maod.
A lot.
Doesn't say a lot.
A lot.
Say a very interesting midrash. How would you say a lot? What? If you wanted to say ma'od, you would say ma'od. If you want to say a lot, you would say? Or you would say ma'od, ma'od. What does it mean? Be ma'od, ma'od. Okay? So I saw, one second. Ah, gemakli yakar. What does the word be ma'od mean? Ma'od. Where else do we find the word ma'od? Anybody familiar with this? Where else, in what context do we see ma'od, a lot, be ma'od, as a noun? Ma'od. You all know this. You all know. You have to add the Shem Elokecha, v'chol levavcha, v'chol nafshecha, v'chol me'odecha. What is me'odecha?
Your
right, and nobody knows. You know why nobody knows? Because the word ma'od means a lot. So let's translate that word. In a pasuk, you should love Hashem v'chol levavcha with all your heart, v'chol nafshecha with all your soul. And with all your
much.
With all your a lot. What in the world does that mean?
As much as you can.
Resources.
With all your
resources.
Where do you get that from?
Subhanscroll.
Very good. Subhanscroll translation. Very good. Chazal. B'chol ma'od. It's very strange, isn't it? B'chol. It's very strange. Ma'od. With all a lot. He told Ma'od, it was very good, with all your very. What? You know what I'm saying? So Chazal interpreted it as, interestingly enough, right? Yeah, he said, the Chazal say, some people like their life more, this is a Gemara in Brachot, like their life more than their money. I said, Ma'od is with your resources, with your financial wherewithal. So some people like their life more than their money. So you should be willing to give up your life for God, even though you like your life more than money. Some people like their money more than their life. So you should be willing to give up all your money for God. So ma'odecha means, according to Art Scroll, and that's based on Rashi, which is based on the Gemara, ma'odecha means your financial wherewithal. So look what Kli Yakar says. What does it mean? Va'ya'atzmu, they became atzum, great. Be ma'od ma'od, says Kli Yakar. Havele lemeimar ma'od ma'od. It should say a lot. Mahu bim ma'od, with ma'od. The Jews were wealthy. You know what I'm saying? So it's about, they were...
They didn't just become plentiful, they also succeeded.
That's right. They were plentiful and successful. Sound familiar? I don't know. Okay? They you know. And this is the story of the Jewish people. This is the story of the Jewish people throughout history. We get to a place, and we start off really small and very weak, and almost overnight... Right, we quickly become A, assimilated, B, culturally Jewish, C, powerful, and D, wealthy. Anybody go to that? We just went to the Diaspora Museum. Anybody to the Diaspora Museum in Tel Aviv University?
Yeah.
He went?
Yeah.
Like, it was a really interesting experience.
Well, the shuls.
What?
The wealth in those shuls.
It was like, to me, it was like the pre-Holocaust museum.
Yeah.
Why? Because it's all the story of, the vast majority of this, the story of Jewish communities that existed in the diaspora, and then, of course, were destroyed. You know what I'm saying? Let's go through the models of all the, let's go through the models of all the shul. See this shul that no longer exists, and that shul that was destroyed, and this shul that no longer, you know what I'm saying? And even, like, they even acknowledge it to some degree. They have, like, a genealogy project. Like, oh, you can list all your names. Beit HaTfutzot is like, living communities, but it's not really living communities because they don't live anymore. You know what I'm saying? If you really wanted to do Beit HaTzitzot, you'd have to do an entirely different museum about like vibrant communities and what Jewish life is like in the diaspora, which is a worthwhile project, but that's not that museum. So if you go, you'll notice what I mean. At the very end, there's this movie. They really haven't updated it in quite a while.
Very dated.
Yeah, very dated. There's this movie about this Jewish family that like the grandfather started in the garment district, you know, selling shmatas on the Lower East Side. And the movie ends, he's living in like Cedarhurst, New York with his, you know, family, and they go to synagogue and they give tons of money in the 80s to like Federation or whatever it is, to the United Jewish Appeal. And it's like, it's the story of like this. This is the story.
And when it's not like that, when you're in Ethiopia or Russia, when it's not like that, then you come here.
Then you come here. Right, no, exactly. You know what I'm saying?
It's connected.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? So it's just, like, I was just, you know, I wonder, I would love for them to go back and see where are the children of that family now. I dare say, I worry. I guarantee you, half of those kids are not married to Jews. Half of them are not married to Jews. You know what I mean? There's no way that they are. You know, there's probably one Chabadnik, you know what I'm saying? There's got to be one probably, like, living on a hilltop somewhere, you know, like. And then the rest of them, you know, went to college and married off and whatever. One's trying to find himself. But, like, it's really sad. You read, like, there's this, they have this wall of, like, family pictures. You see, you know what I'm talking about? This wall of, like, old family pictures from the old country. And then they do this, like, where are the different people? Yeah. This guy's in a university somewhere, and they're living in Hawaii, and this guy's on a kibbutz somewhere. You know what I'm saying? It's for anybody to think that museum is really Beit HaTzitzot and not pre-Yad Vashem is just kidding themselves. It's just the story of Yad Vashem before Yad Vashem happened. I don't know. That was my... Have you been to that museum? Do you disagree with me? What? That was the takeaway. Interesting.
What did his mom say?
It was very nice to see all the shuls and see how, like, what was the thing.
Beautiful architecture, wonderful buildings, they're all gone. Okay. How did it happen? How much time do I have? Almost none, right?
10 minutes.
Really?
Nine minutes.
9 minutes. Where's the watch when you need it? Okay. What happened? Vayakam melech chadash al Mitzrayim asher lo yada et Yosef. Right, and obviously that's a problem. Why is it a problem? You're already answering the question. Tell me the question before you answer it. What? How could he have known Yosef? Everyone asks this question. Everyone has a different answer. Look at Rashi for a second. Rashi gives two answers. Okay? Vayakam melech chadash. Rab u'shmuel. It's machloket in the Gemara. Chad amar chadash mamash. Amar Rashi on chet. Rab u'shmuel. This is a very good question. But you should do this on you do this Friday night. What?
Right, which is
right. Rabbi Shmuel, let's see in a second. Chad amar chadash mamash. One says he was a new king. Chad amar shenit chadesh gzerotav. And one said, same guy,
different personality.
Okay. So and so there are long discussions about which one is correct. And the answer is both of them are really correct. So what happened? So some say that there was this geopolitical shift in Egypt. Remember, by the way, what did Yosef do to Egypt when he saved them?
He made it a powerhouse.
He made the pharaoh, he shifted the entire country, right? What did they do? They came and said, we need food. He said, okay, I'll sell you food. When they ran out of money, what did they sell? They sold their land, they sold their... He didn't, by the way, he didn't make them sell themselves. It says over and over again, they wanted to sell themselves as slaves to the pharaoh, and he didn't buy them. Right? He made them indentured servants to the land. He made them sharecroppers. In a sense, the pharaoh always got 20%, and they always took 80. But at some point, you know, if you don't have a good crop one year or whatever, you always just get further and further and further in debt. So one could very well see, like, when, like, it was great when he saved them from starvation, but 20 years later, and 30 years later, and 40 years later, you're still paying the pharaoh. And you start to wonder, well, why am I paying pharaoh? And what does pharaoh say? Was it?
Hello,
Yosef. Wasn't me! It was the Jews. Right? It was his idea. Right? And by the what? What's that? It was the chief of staff. You know, so I'm listening to this radio show. Apparently, there's this movie that's going around. that's promoting this idea of there are like two or three banks that like control world finance, you know, like the famous thing, you know. And the radio host goes, he says, my son came to me and said, you got to see this movie, Dad. And I said, no, you can't believe any of that. And he says, but then again, Goldman Sachs, you know what I'm saying? Like, this is, you know, like, it's so easy to see, like, everything turning on a dime. Let's imagine that the economy of the world doesn't turn around and it just goes bad. It just goes bad. Is that so hard to imagine? Whose fault is that?
Cheers.
Asher lo yadat yosef. Right? So one of two possible things happened. Parah was deposed by Yaka Melech Hadash. It doesn't say by Yimloch Tachtav. A new king arose, which means he wasn't a king before. What better proof is there? Right? Who didn't suffer? You know what I'm saying? Right? Israel economy is booming. Asher lo yadat yosef. So it could either be a brand new king who really didn't know Yosef. Why didn't he know Yosef? Because he was anti-Yosef. It was a totally different political movement. Or it was the same king who got in religion. And did I ever tell you the story? I'm a big supporter of APEC.
Possibly he could still be alive. I mean,
Yosef is dead. No, but Yamat Yosef.
No, but I'm saying the new king.
Yeah, same king.
How many years, how old was he?
What do you mean? Oh, after Yosef died? It would be his son who was alive, you know what I'm saying, when Yosef last died, right? Who remembers Yosef. But like the same king who didn't know Yosef, how could you not know Yosef? Yosef saved the country. Because Yosef, in saving the country, also transformed the country. And in transforming the country, when things aren't as good as you think they are, you're looking for somebody to blame. And by the way, how are the Jews doing?
Well.
They're doing great. Right? Now, the land of Goshen is booming. Malls. Development, everything is terrific. Yeshivas, what? They take care of each other. There's high, you know what I'm saying? And they don't marry into us. Mm-hmm. They don't want to share. They're like different. They stay to themselves. And that's true. This is really suspicious. You know what I'm saying? So this idea about this, it's so. Oh, I was at APEC convention, and it was great. Like if you're living in America or whatever, and you want to support Israel, the best way to support Israel, I firmly believe, is to be active in APEC. Well, the best way to support is make Aliyah, but if you're not, is to be active and to be involved in APEC, because it really does. It has an effect, and it's an important effect, a really powerful effect. So I was at this convention, and it was unbelievable to see government official after government official after government official get up and repeat the APEC talking points. About the partnership, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's really powerful when you're involved to, on the one hand, to hear their message and then to hear, you know, the Secretary of State of the United States say the same thing, say exactly what their message is. Or, like,
in that room.
What?
In that room.
Not even that room. You know what I'm saying? You watch the news, you'll see, if you're familiar with the things that they do and you get their emails, they're very, very disciplined and really good at staying on message. This is what we're focusing on, and we're going to focus on it again and again and again. And over time, Secretary of Defense of the United States will say it on a news report, and nobody in APEC is in the room. It's very good. It's very powerful and great. But to hear that again and again and again, you realize the reason why politicians say things is for one reason and one reason only. Why do politicians say anything?
To get elected.
There's only one reason to say it, and APEC deeply understands this. Grassroots. So that the reason they say it, because it gets them elected. The minute that it wouldn't get them elected,
they would stop saying.
The moment, and it's just the sense that I had in the room. That, like, just being among politicians, that's what politicians do. They're not fickle. They want to get elected. So they say what they need to say in order to get elected because they represent the people they represent. And if the people they represent would change, they would change in a heartbeat. And that's something that people don't, like, no, it's deep-rooted. It would never change. It would never shift. It would never whatever. It's so, so tenuous.
Look at J Street.
What?
Look at J Street.
Mm-hmm. J Street is even still supporting of Israel. I don't want to. That's like a sub fight.
I'm saying even within, it's not so deep-rooted.
Right. Okay. But yeah, it's even with the Jews themselves. What did we say? Jews in America don't fight, right? You know what I'm saying? Vayomer El Amo, and he says to himself, Hine Am Bnei Yisrael. Rav Ratzumi, man, what does he say about them? Such interesting. Hine, behold, Am Bnei Yisrael. This nation, the Bnei Yisrael, he calls them a nation. What do the Jews themselves think of themselves by that time? Did they think of themselves as a separate nation? They probably didn't. They thought, yeah, we're like the Jewish community of Goshen living among Egypt. We're We are faithful and devoted Egyptian citizens. And it's very interesting. I was saying, he says, Hava nitchak malo. Let's be smart about them. Pen your bear, lest they become even greater. Vayaki tikrena milchama. If a war would happen, it would be hu al sonenu. And they'll join our enemies. Vinilcham banu fight with us. Va'ala min ha'aretz. And they'll run away. So the Midrash says, Rashi says, "Why does Allah mean they'll run away?" It doesn't mean they'll run away. It means that they will conquer us. They'll overtake us. It's interesting to note that the Midrash says that "Vayavirotam befarech." Befarech means like they enslave them, enslavement. Beperach, with a soft mouth. So the Midrash says, "How do they do it?" So the Midrash says the way they did it was the following: One day, Pharaoh said, "Okay, we're all going to go and do work projects. Everybody does a work project." And the Pharaoh got his trough and his shovel, and he's like, start working. And we're like, we're building bricks, and everybody's building bricks together. And they say to the Jews, according to the Midrash, there are two Midrashim. Some of the Jews voluntarily joined Pharaoh in civil duty. And some say, Pharaoh said, however many bricks you lay today, I'll pay you for each brick. So, of course, what did the Jews do? Tons of bricks, more money. And the next day, Pharaoh said, all those bricks that you laid yesterday, today you're going to do it for nothing. But now I know how many you really could do. You know what I'm saying? So our own greed if I can get us in trouble. But it's the perach, it's the soft mouth, the power said. Okay, that gets us started. But the idea is, Hine am b'nei Yisrael. He looks at the Egyptians, says to the Egyptians, he says, there's this separate people in our midst. This am b'nei Yisrael. There's a nation in our nation. And they're dangerous to us. They don't want to become part of us. Everybody else, you know what I'm saying? There's always this undertone, actually, that they say about Jews. There's always this, like, you know, what's the undertone? Like, it's a question, especially with Israel today. Where does your loyalty really lie? Even today. You know what I'm saying? What are you? Is your initial allegiance to wherever country you're in? Australia? Or are you really? Is you really a Jew? You're really, you know, something
else.
What
are you first?
What? Right. That's this Am B'nai Israel. There's this nation in our midst. And by the way, who repeated this? Who repeated this word for word? There's this nation, and they don't want to have anything to do with us, and they stay separate.
Hitler
for sure. Before Hitler, well before Hitler, he said explicitly.
Haman.
Very good. Very good. What did Haman say? Mezufuzah umufarad. They stay separate. And why do they say this? Why do they say it? There's a very good reason why they say it. That's right, because it's true. And why is it true? Come back to where we started. The reason it's true is because ideally we're not supposed to be there. If we remember that we're not supposed to be there, that's why we remain separate. The problem is, today, we still stay separate. But unfortunately, one gets the sense that we've forgotten that we're not supposed to be there. And that's the most frightening thing of all. Because when the Jews who are carrying the flag of the Torah, okay, it's one thing to say, then, you know, people assimilate. It's a tragedy. It's terrible. They don't remember. They've assimilated. They don't have that identity. But when Jews who carry the flag of the Torah, you know, oh, Aliyah is great. For people who do that kind of thing. When they've forgotten that they're really not supposed to be there, that's when you start to get a little nervous. You don't know how, you don't know why, you don't know what. But it certainly isn't the harbinger of good things to come. And with that depressing note.